This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Today, we honor the Marfield National Book Award for Writing in the Arts. And this is presented and established by the Arts Club of Washington, D.C. And this club presents this award. It's equal to the Pulitzer Prize. However, it happens to be a writing specifically about the arts. And the author is Rachel Corbett. She's come to us from New York. We are so happy. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
What is the title of your award-winning book?
It's called You Must Change Your Life, The Story of Rainer Maria Rilke and Auguste Rodin.
And where did you get that title? It sounds familiar.
Right. It's the final line in Rilke's poem, The Archaic Torso of Apollo.
So that is a line from, many times we've heard You Must Change Your Life, but I don't know if many people know the origin of it. So it is Rilke's poem. Yes. So Rachel Corbett has written this book. It is her first book, the winning of a National Book Award. The second book will have to win the Nobel Prize. You don't want to go backwards. And we're so happy to have you. So who was Auguste Rodin?
Well, he was the famous sculptor, and at the time we meet him in the book, he's in his 60s. He's just finished The Thinker, one of his most famous works, and he's well into the gates of hell. And he's a world-renowned sculptor. He's starting to become very famous, very rich. And at this point, he meets the young poet Rilke, who's in his 20s when he comes to Paris to write a monograph about Rodin.
And together, they form a great relationship, and the book is about that relationship. I want to tell you who she is. Rachel Corbett is editor-in-chief of Modern Painters magazine. Her writing has appeared in the best of writing establishments, The New Yorker, New York Times, the art newspaper, New York Magazine, and she lives in Brooklyn, New York. You Must Change Your Life is her first book. She's going to read us a bit of it and set it up for us, please.
So this section takes place right when Rilke goes to Rodin's studio for the first time in Meudon, which is his kind of country estate, and this is where the real production happens. They went to the studio, a long building encased almost entirely in glass. When Rodin opened the door, the sight left Rilke speechless. It contained what looked like the work of a century. The workshop pulsed like an ecosystem, with white-smocked craftsmen carving away at hunks of marble, setting flames inside brick kilns, and hauling blocks of stone across the floor. The sun poured in through the arched glass, lighting up the rows of plaster bodies like angels, Rilke thought, or inhabitants of an aquarium. The bright whiteness seared his pale eyes. It was almost too much to bear, but that didn't stop him from greedily trying to take it all in anyway. After a few minutes, Rodin left his awestruck visitor to look around on his own. Rilke didn't know where to begin. There were acres of half-made sculptures, limbs piling up on tabletops, a torso with the wrong head attached, arms and legs intertwined, striding and reaching. It looked like a storm had torn through a village and scattered body parts everywhere. There were works that Rilke had only read about in books, including several yard-long sections of the Gates of Hell, uncast and strewn about shelves and display cases. It became clear that Rodin prized hands above all other parts of the body. A well-informed visitor knew that to please the master, one should ask him, "May I look at the hands?" They appeared around the studio in all configurations. Old wise hands, a pair of clenched fists, two fingertips pitched into a cathedral spire. Rodin once claimed to have sculpted 12,000 hands, only to have smashed up 10,000 of them. Just as he'd previously spent years molding hands and feet for his old employer, Carrier Belleuse, Rodin now tested prospective apprentices on their facility with hands. Rilke understood immediately the lesson contained in all of these hands, often no bigger than my little finger, but filled with a life that makes one's heart pound, each a feeling, each a bit of love, devotion, kindness, and searching. Whenever Rilke had described hands in his poetry, they were always extensions into the world. They were need, a woman reaching for a lover, a child grasping its mother, a mentor pointing the way to a disciple. But for Rodin, a hand was its own landscape, complete and internally resolved. Rodin seemed to dream with his hands rather than his head, Rilke thought, enabling him to make his every fantasy real. Rilke only wished that Rodin would now take the poet himself into those transformative hands. He believed his calling was predestined. He just needed a master to animate it.
There we have the setting, and we can see visually, we can tell you're an artist because of the visuals. Are you a painter?
No, not at all.
But you are a noticer. You certainly are a watcher. You are a photographer of the world because that is such an explicit scene of his messy studio with different parts of the anatomy strewn all over. And that is just so apparent to me what Rilke must have seen. And when you thought about this, what was your first feeling about what Rodin must have been like? What was your impression of him to live in such a way?
Well, he really lived in his work. His work was his entire life. So when he lives, you know, surrounded by it. At one point, Rilke observes that he is like a child who's just among all of his toys. You know, it's the place he wants to be most.
I know it. Yes. So Rachel Corbett has won this book, and it's important to go on to explain that this book is the only award in the country that is for writing on the arts, which one would think we would have had one before this time. And that means that the award is given to a book in dance or photography or visual arts, any kind of form. And so what do you think this book is given for? Criticism, biography, explication of the arts?
Well, I think specifically this award is also looking, it seeks to award a book that's meant to be kind of more accessible, that's not so much a scholarly book of criticism, or, so I consider my book, it's a biography.
It's a good read.
You know, I hope so. Yeah.
That's the point for the general public.
Right.
So that is the important difference, that this is a book on the arts where everyone is invited to the party.
Right.
Right. Tell us then about what the book covers in terms of the span of time from where you begin in the which century and what do you bring us to?
So the book starts with kind of two mini biographies of each figure just to get their background. So we start in 1840 when Rodin is born, and then we jump ahead a few decades later when Rilke is born. But it really sort of takes off in 1902, which is the year they meet. And that's the year that Rilke moves from Germany to Paris. And then from about 1902 to 1908 are the years that they are really together, either when Rilke is working as his kind of biographer, right?
Secretary, really.
And then later his secretary, yes. And then kind of apprentice the whole way through for his own, trying to learn from the artist on how to see the world, and it's for his own purposes.
Tell us about their personality differences.
Yeah, they're very different. Rodin is stoic and stern and serious, a man of few words. He believes that one should not indulge in any pleasures or comforts. You shouldn't drink too much. You shouldn't even have cushions on your chairs because that's too indulgent. Children, women, they all get in the way of your work. Rilke is also very serious, but he's much softer. He's sensitive, and he is very social. He very much depends on others for comforts, and he never is fully able to sort of subjugate his heart in the way that Rodin commands.
Why did Rilke want to write about? What did he write about Rodin? What was his first major publication about Rodin?
So he wrote the monograph that he was commissioned to write.
And what is a monograph?
A monograph is it's a short book about an artist, looking at their body of work up until that point, basically. It's a study of an artist. And it was simply called Auguste Rodin. And it's a praise like no other. I mean, it's just, he just sings his praises of Rodin and calls him, you know, basically the world's greatest sculptor. He goes through and writes with these amazing superlatives on every single sculpture. And
did Rodin like that?
Rodin did. Well, once Rodin finally saw a French translation of the book sometime later, he was very impressed because it was very flattering.
Well, Rodin spoke German.
Rodin did not. Rodin only spoke French, but the book was translated later into French, and he read that version.
And what, but they both spoke the same language?
Rilke learned French. In the beginning, not well, so that was a stumbling block for
and
them.
And what was Rilke's original language?
German.
Aha, so he was the one that spoke German. And gradually, and yet they communicated.
Yeah.
Somehow. So would you believe that Rilke was subjugated in a way and was definitely not, did not see himself as an equal artist as Rodin, even though the world now does regard him as one of the greatest poets of all time?
Right. At that time, he wasn't. He was 26. He had writer's block. He had written a couple of books that didn't sell well, weren't received well. He was still considered a bit too sentimental, a bit too much in the German Romantic tradition, and he hadn't found his own style yet. And it was through going to Paris and meeting Rodin that I argue he found his more modern style and the style that came to define him as a poet later. So he wrote his book of new poems there, which is a very... They're poems based on objects. So he was studying objects and studying how to look at objects more simply and to just describe them. And I think through that process, which certainly came from Rodin, he was able to pull back from making these massive love poems that weren't really working for him. He kind of had to start small and relearn how to...
Not with the abstract.
Right.
Would you argue that without this experience, we would not know Rilke today, that his poetry would not have reached the heights that it has?
Yeah, it's hard to speculate, but I can't believe he would be the same poet. And the poems that these very modern new poems, or thing poems, as he called them, are not his best known poems today, but they definitely marked the turn that led him to the Do We Know Elegies and what we do know him for today.
And first he learned how to see. I think that was one thing he might not have had before. Rachel Corbett is here. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and her book is You Must Change Your Life. Read us another bit of it and set it up, please.
Okay, so this is, they've now spent about a week and a half together, and Rilke is just in awe of Rodin's work. And he's worried because his French isn't so good, but he's trying his best to communicate with him anyway. So after just 10 days with Rodin, Rilke sent his new master a letter. He confessed that it might seem strange to write since they saw each other so often, but he felt the language barrier prevented him from fully expressing himself. In the quiet of his little room, he could work out the words to tell Rodin precisely how much he had inspired him. He'd given him the strength to suffer through loneliness, to accept sacrifice, and to disarm even the anxieties of poverty. He told him that his wife had agreed with him on this and would be joining him in Paris soon. If they could both find work there, they hoped to stay indefinitely. He sensed that this journey would prove the great rebirth of my life. Rilke also sent Rodin a few lines of poetry that had come to him during a recent stroll through the Luxembourg Gardens. Why do I write these verses? Not because I dare to believe that they are good, but it's the desire to draw near to you that guides my hand, he wrote. Rodin had become the example for my life and my art. Rilke knew his German verses would be incomprehensible to Rodin, but he longed to have the man's eyes rest upon them all the same. Then he came to the real point of his letter. It's not just to write a study that I have come to you, he confessed. It is to ask you, how should I live? We don't know whether Rodin replied to the letter, but he offered the poet an open invitation to his studios over the next 4 months, which was all the encouragement Rilke needed to attach himself to the master at every moment. On the best days, Rodin invited him to Meudon in the mornings. Rilke would come prepared with a list of questions, and they would sit by the pond or take a walk, their discussions often carrying on well into the afternoon. Rodin enjoined coining new metaphors for his disciple, and Rilke dutifully scribbled them down. Look, it takes only one night. In a single night, all these gills are formed, Rodin said once of a mushroom he plucked from the ground. Turning it over to reveal his underside, he explained, that's good work. Other days, Rilke stood by in the studio to watch Rodin in action. He observed the way the artist wielded his tools like swords, remorselessly amputating limbs and heads with a single slice, slashing out swaths of clay until he ran out of breath,